they'd be willing to give up, they'll answer that everything is critically important, and they won't be happy with less. The reality outside of the focus group is always quite different. Shortly after the group adjourns, each of those participants will go out and purchase something that is not free and not perfect, and they'll be happy with their decision. Why? As a rule, people never accept trade-offs unless they're forced to make a decision. If the perfect option existed, they'd buy it. Since there's no such thing as the perfect offering, people are happy to settle for the next best alternative. The best way to discover what people actually value is to ask them to make explicit trade-offs during the research process. The problem with the hypothetical focus group was that it didn't ask the participants to make any real decisions. The participants could have everything, so they wanted everything. Relative importance testing, a set of analysis techniques pioneered by statistician Jordan Louvier in the 1980s, gives you a way to determine what people actually want by asking them a series of simple questions designed to simulate real-life trade-offs. Here's how it works. Let's assume we're conducting a relative importance test for the diner previously mentioned. Instead of asking the participant to rank each benefit from 0 to 10, we show the participant something like the following. A. Orders delivered to the table in 5 minutes or less. B. Most entree prices under $20. C. Appealing restaurant decor. And D. Large variety of menu options. After this set is shown, the participant is asked the following questions. Number 1. Which of these items is most important? And number 2. Which of these items is least important? Once the participant answers the questions, another set of options is shown. E. Unique entrees I can't get anywhere else. F. Knowing that I can always order my favorite dishes. G. People are impressed that I dine here. And H. Large portions. Random question sets containing 4 or 5 criteria are provided until there are no more possible combinations or the participant's attention wanders, which typically occurs around the 5 to 10 minute mark. It won't take the participant long to provide a response to each of these simple questions, but the results are quite revealing. By asking the participant to make an actual choice, you're collecting more accurate information about how the participant would respond when faced with a similar choice in the real world. When the results are aggregated and statistically analyzed, the relative importance of each benefit becomes very clear. The more sets each participant completes, the more clearly you'll be able to judge the relative importance of each benefit. Relative importance testing can help you quickly determine which benefits you should focus on to make your offering maximally attractive. Critical assumptions. Imagine that you're interested in opening a yoga studio. The market opportunity looks good. You believe that you've identified an underserved neighborhood with significant demand and enough discretionary income to pay a $100 a month membership fee. You've sketched out what the space would look like, and you have a rough idea of the different styles you'd like to offer and whom you'd bring in to teach classes. You've found a suitable location that you can rent for around $10,000 per month if you sign a 12-month lease, and you estimate that you'll need an additional $12,000 per month to pay employee salaries and other monthly operating expenses. You'll also need to spend around $5,000 upfront for equipment, mats, blocks, and a computer to handle membership records. The commercial real estate agent you're working with is putting pressure on you to move quickly, saying the location you want may be snatched up by another tenant if you don't commit now. Your life savings are enough to cover the startup costs and 3 months of projected operating expenses. You're excited, but you want to ensure that you're making the right decision before you move forward. Should you sign the lease? Stories like this are very common. An excited first-time entrepreneur has a dream of owning a restaurant, a bar, or a bookstore, so they invest their life savings and take on significant debt to open the new business. Sometimes these stories work out well. More often than not, in a few months, the new entrepreneur is bankrupt and out of business, wondering how things went so terribly wrong. Critical assumptions are facts or characteristics that must be true in the real world for your business or offering to be successful. Every new business or offering has a set of critical assumptions, and if any critical assumptions turn out to be false, the business idea will be vastly less promising than it appears. The yoga studio example above has 3 primary critical assumptions. Number 1. Individuals in this neighborhood will be willing to commit to pay $100 or more per month for a yoga membership close to their home. Number two, the business will be able to attract at least 220 members paying full price within 3 months. Number three, total monthly revenues will exceed $22,000 for the next 12 months, which is the minimum duration of the lease term. Let's examine what would happen to the yoga studio if these critical assumptions turn out to be false. Number one, initial interest is high, but most of the people who tour the new studio balk at paying $100 per month, saying they'd rather drive a few miles and pay $75. The studio lowers prices to $75, which means 300 members are now required to keep the studio afloat. After lowering prices, membership reaches the 220 member mark as planned, but it's not enough to keep the studio open. Number two, the studio doesn't attract enough members to pay the bills because yoga enthusiasts in the neighborhood are already locked into a 12-month membership contract with a studio a few miles away. The studio runs out of money quickly and closes. Number three, a very nice competing studio opens up in the same neighborhood around the same time. After 3 months, the studio only has half of the members it needs to sustain itself. With 9 more months on the lease, the financial outlook is bleak. Every business or offering has a set of critical assumptions that will make or break its continued existence. The more accurately you can identify these assumptions in advance and actually test whether or not they're true, the less risk you'll be taking and the more confidence you'll have in the wisdom of your decisions. Shadow testing. The best way to validate the truth of your critical assumptions is to test them directly, but going through the entire process of starting the business is needlessly risky and expensive. It's much smarter to minimize your risk by testing your offering with real paying customers before you fully commit to making it real. Shadow testing is the process of selling an offering before it actually exists. As long as you're completely upfront with your potential customers that the offering is still in development, shadow testing is a very useful strategy you can use to actually test your critical assumptions with real customers quickly and inexpensively. Real paying customers are always different from hypothetical customers. Shadow testing allows you to get a critical piece of customer feedback you can get in no other way, whether or not people will actually pay for what you're developing. In order to minimize the risk you're taking on in committing to the project, your objective should be to start gathering data from real paying customers as soon as possible. Fitbit is a company that knows the value of shadow testing. Founded by Eric Friedman and James Park in September 2008, Fitbit makes a small clip-on exercise and sleep data gathering device. The Fitbit device tracks your activity levels throughout the day and the night, then automatically uploads your data to the web, where it analyzes your health, fitness, and sleep patterns. It's a neat concept, but creating new hardware is time-consuming, expensive, and risky. So here's what Friedman and Park did. The same day they announced the Fitbit idea to the world, they started allowing customers to pre-order a Fitbit on their website, based on little more than a description of what the device would do and a few renderings of what the product would look like. The billing system collected names, addresses, and verified credit card numbers, but no charges were actually processed until the product was ready to ship, which gave the company an out in case their plans fell through. Orders started rolling in, and 1 month later, investors had the confidence to pony up $2 million to make the Fitbit a reality. A year later, the first real Fitbit was shipped to customers. That's the power of shadow testing. Minimum viable offer. In order to conduct a shadow test, you need something to sell. Fortunately, you don't have to create the entire offer before you start selling. A minimum viable offer is an offer that promises and/or provides the smallest number of benefits necessary to produce an actual sale. A minimum viable offer is essentially a prototype that's been developed to the point that someone will actually pull out their wallet and commit to making a purchase. It doesn't have to be complicated. Fitbit's minimum viable offer was a prototype, a description, and a few computer renderings. All you need to do is convey enough information to convince a real potential customer to buy. Creating a minimum viable offer is useful because it's impossible to predict 100% accurately what will work in advance. You don't want to invest a ton of time and money in something that has no chance of working, and the faster you can figure out if your idea will work or not, the better off you'll be. Since feedback from prospective customers and paid in full orders are very different things, creating a minimum viable offer allows you to start collecting data from real customers as quickly as possible, directly testing the idea's critical assumptions, and reducing the risk of making a business-ending investment decision. Here's how the hypothetical yoga studio we discussed earlier could use a minimum viable offer and shadow testing to evaluate their critical assumptions. Step 1. Create a simple website describing the studio in detail, including location, tentative schedule, teaching staff, sketches of the space, and membership fees. The site includes a sign-up form for visitors to pre-order memberships by submitting their credit card information. By signing up, members commit to a 12-month membership when the studio opens, but they have the opportunity to cancel within the first month if they don't like it. If the studio doesn't open, all pre-orders are canceled without charge. Total cost? A few hundred dollars. Step 2. Direct prospective customers to the website. This can be done inexpensively in any number of ways. Flyers, door-to-door inquiry, direct mail, and local search engine advertising. Total cost? A few hundred dollars. Step 3. Track how many individuals sign up for pre-opening memberships at the full rate via the website or request additional information. Total cost? A few hours of analysis. This method of testing is simple, fast, and inexpensive. Services like Kickstarter.com are making tests like this easy. All it takes to allow potential customers to pre-order is a video, a few sketches or renderings, and basic sales copy. Spending a few hours and a few hundred dollars testing your critical assumptions is a very good use of money, particularly if your findings indicate your business idea won't work. The purpose of starting with a minimum viable offer is to minimize your risk. By keeping the investment small, incremental, and learning-oriented, you'll be able to quickly discover what works and what doesn't. If the idea is promising, you're in a great position to make it happen. If your assumptions don't hold true, you're able to cut your losses without losing your shirt or your dignity. Incremental augmentation. Once your minimum viable offer is selling and you've proven that your critical assumptions are valid, you're in good shape, but you're not finished. If you're committed to making your offer as good as it can be, you'll need to keep making small changes that improve the offer if you want to stay competitive and attract more customers. Incremental augmentation is the process of using the iteration cycle to add new benefits to an existing offer. The process is simple. Keep making and testing additions to the core offer, continue doing what works, and stop doing what doesn't. The process of customizing cars is an example of incremental augmentation. Starting with a stock car, the tuner steadily replaces and upgrades parts, a better engine, spoiler, tinted windows, and chrome hubcaps. The intent of every change is to make the car just a little bit better until it's the best it can be. When the car is finished, it's a different machine. Incremental augmentation helps you improve your offering while minimizing the risk that any single iteration will fail catastrophically. If you're not careful, drastic changes after launch can eliminate the qualities that made your offer attractive or break the systems you use to create the value you're providing to your customers. By making and testing changes quickly and incrementally, you can continually improve your offer without betting the farm, helping you create even more value for your customers over time. Keep in mind that incremental augmentation can only take you so far. In order to enter a new market or change the game, you may need to create something completely new. If that's the case, start over with a new prototype and work your way through the value creation process from the beginning. When it's ready, get feedback and use testing to compare the new version with the old to make sure it's actually better before you launch it. Field testing. 150 days a year, Patrick Smith lives in the Colorado wilderness, just as he has for the past 50 years. Smith is the founder of the Colorado School of Outdoor Living and two successful hunting and backpacking companies, Mountain Smith, which he sold in 1995, and Kifaru International, which he created in 1997. Becoming a Kifaru customer is a quick way to overheat your credit card. Kifaru makes arguably the best hiking and hunting packs and shelters in the world, extremely rugged, lightweight, and well-designed. Kifaru packs can carry 200 pounds comfortably, will last for decades, and sell for hundreds of dollars. It's not uncommon for avid sportsmen and soldiers to shell out thousands of dollars for custom-made Kafaru gear, then wait eagerly for 6 to 8 weeks while the company makes it. Try as you might, it's extremely difficult to find a Kafaru customer who's disappointed in the quality of their gear. More often than not, a new Kafaru customer is a customer for life. The secret behind Kafaru's quality is field testing. Smith personally creates, uses, and iterates every single product Kafaru makes for years before offering it to customers. By the time the finished product is available, even the most demanding customers have a difficult time finding flaws. Here's what Smith says about his personal approach to field testing, and I quote, "The backcountry is definitely both my inspiration and my laboratory. I figured out how to create designs out there in the field. I trust this technique. I get instant feedback about designs because I'm in the backcountry doing the things the design is for. I really do think this is a better design process than sitting in front of a computer in an office in town. I think it's a win-win situation." Field testing has a long and distinguished history in the creation of successful businesses. In 1923, W.H. Murphy of the Protective Garment Corporation of New York had an associate shoot him in the chest from 10 feet away in front of a public audience to prove his product worked, a marketing stunt based on extensive field testing to verify that the vest was capable of stopping live bullets. Miguel Caballero, a Colombian suit manufacturer who has created bulletproof suits for heads of state like Barack Obama and Hugo Chavez, has continued the tradition by posting videos of people wearing his suits being shot point blank in the stomach on YouTube. Most major automotive manufacturers put new car designs through on- and off-road obstacle courses to test performance and handling in real-world conditions. Software companies like Microsoft and Google extensively field test their new products internally with employees before releasing them to customers. Testing internally allows the company to eliminate any bugs before customers ever see the product. Using what you make every day is the best way to improve the quality of what you're offering. Nothing will help you find ways to make your offer better than being its most avid and demanding customer. Chapter 2. Marketing. Offering value is not enough. If no one knows or cares about what you have to offer, it doesn't matter how much value you create. Without marketing, no business can survive. People who don't know you exist can't purchase what you have to offer, and people who aren't interested in what you have to offer won't become paying customers. Every successful business finds a way to attract the attention of the right people and make them interested in what's being offered. Without prospects, you won't sell anything, and without completing profitable transactions, your business will fail. Marketing is the art and science of finding prospects, people who are actively interested in what you have to offer. The best businesses in the world find ways to attract the attention of qualified prospects quickly and inexpensively. The more prospects you entice, the better off your business will be. Marketing is not the same thing as selling. While direct marketing strategies often try to minimize the time between attracting attention and asking for the sale, marketing and selling are two different things. Marketing is about getting noticed. Sales, which we'll discuss in Chapter 3, is about closing the deal. Attention. Modern life is overloaded with demands on your attention. Think of all the things that are competing for your attention right now. There's work to be done, people to call, email to check, TV to watch, music to listen to, and countless websites to visit. Everyone has too many things to do and too little time to do them all. Rule number one of marketing is that your potential customer's available attention is limited. Keeping up with everything in your world would require way more attention than you actually have to work with. To compensate, you filter. You ration your attention, allocating more to things you care about and less to things you don't. So does everyone else, including your potential prospects. To get someone's attention, you have to find a way around their filters. High-quality attention must be earned. When you're seeking someone's attention, it's useful to take a moment to remember that you're competing against everything else in their world. In order to be noticed, you need to find a way to earn that attention by being more interesting or useful than the competing alternatives. Attention doesn't matter if people don't care about what you're doing. If all you're looking for is attention, don't bother with all this business stuff. Skipping down the street in a pink bunny suit while yelling at the top of your lungs will get you all the attention that you'll ever want. When it comes to business, however, some kinds of attention aren't worth having. You want the attention of prospects who will ultimately purchase from you. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. It's nice to be the center of attention, but business is about making profitable sales, not winning a popularity contest. Being featured on national television or on a huge website is a wonderful thing, but very often this kind of broad publicity fails to deliver actual sales. Spending time and energy acting like a socialite reduces the amount of resources you can devote to creating real value for your customers, which doesn't help anyone. Earn the attention of the people who are likely to buy from you, and you'll inevitably build your business. The mental models in this chapter will show you how. Receptivity. People ignore what they don't care about. One of the primary functions of the human brain is perceptual filtering, determining what to pay attention to and what to ignore. The fastest way to be ignored by anyone is to start talking about something they don't care about. Receptivity is a measure of how open a person is to your message. Rabid fans of hit novels like Stephanie Meyer's Twilight books are paragons of receptivity. They're interested in almost anything they can find about their obsession as soon as it's available. From a business perspective, that's ideal. It's difficult to offer something that this audience won't want immediately. On the other hand, a committed ethical vegan isn't likely to be interested in hearing about the benefits of red meat consumption, regardless of how much disconfirming evidence there is or how compelling the presentation. The worldview mismatch is just too big, and even the largest publicity campaign won't be able to overcome the overwhelming urge to ignore. Receptivity has two primary components: what and when. People tend to be receptive only to certain categories of things at certain times. I love hearing about great new business books, but I never want to be on the receiving end of a 3 a.m. phone call from a publicist. If you want your message to be heard, the medium matters. The form of your message has a big influence on how receptive people are to the information that message contains. If the form of your message suggests that it was created just for them, you're far more likely to get your prospects' attention. Here's an example. Almost everyone will ignore postal junk mail. If it looks blatantly commercial or mass-produced, there's a 99% chance the recipient will throw it away without a second thought. Change the form, however, and the receptivity changes as well. Most people will at least open a hand-addressed envelope, since it's clear someone spent time and effort sending it to them. Taken to an extreme, almost everyone, including busy executives, will open and look through the contents of a large overnight hand-addressed FedEx envelope. It's big, expensive, and clearly requires effort to send. Even then, if the contents don't match what they're interested in, you'll lose their attention immediately. Remarkability. Every time I go for a run, people ask me about my shoes. They don't ask me because they're fashionable. They ask me because they're weird. Vibram Five Fingers are shoes that look like a cross between a sock and a glove. Wearing them makes you look a bit like a frog. Each toe has its own little pocket, giving your feet a slightly amphibian look, odd enough to be noticed. I picked up a pair of Five Fingers to experiment with barefoot running. The thin rubber sole protects your feet from rocks and glass without adding any unnecessary support, which lets your feet do what they're naturally designed to do. Running or walking in Five Fingers is surprisingly fun, which is why I keep wearing them. Five Fingers are just strange enough that people can't help but notice your feet when you wear them. They violate expectations of what shoes are supposed to look like. As a result, people ask me about them constantly, even in as unfriendly a place as the streets of New York City. By the end of the conversation, I've inevitably told my new acquaintance what they are, why I'm wearing them, how much they cost, and where they can purchase them. Five Fingers are designed to overcome the number one problem every new offering faces. If no one knows you exist, no one will buy what you have to sell. Every customer who wears a pair of Five Fingers inevitably provides Vibram all of the advertising they need to keep growing, for free. From a business perspective, the attention-grabbing design of Five Fingers is working beautifully. On the street, salespeople confirm that Five Fingers are flying off the shelves. New stock sells out almost immediately. According to the New York Times, in an article titled Wiggling Their Toes at the Shoe Giants, sales of the Five Fingers line have tripled every year since they were introduced in 2006, and in 2009, revenue crossed the $10 million mark in North America without mass market advertising. Not bad for funny-looking frog shoes. Being remarkable is the best way to attract attention. In the classic marketing book Purple Cow, Seth Godin uses a wonderful metaphor to illustrate this principle. A field full of brown cows is boring. A purple cow violates the viewer's expectations, which naturally attracts attention and interest. If you design your offer to be remarkable, unique enough to pique your prospect's curiosity, it'll be significantly easier to attract attention. Probable purchaser. Assuming that everyone in the world cares about what you have to offer is a huge marketing mistake. You may think that what you have to offer is the greatest thing since sliced bread. In fact, I hope you do. That doesn't change the fact that it's not right for everyone. Whatever you're offering, I can guarantee you that most of the people in this world don't and will never care about what you're doing. Harsh, but true. Fortunately, you don't have to appeal to everyone in order to succeed. You just have to attract enough attention to close enough sales to produce enough profit to keep going. To do that, it's best to focus on attracting the attention of the people who will actually care about what you're doing. Skilled marketers don't try to get everyone's attention. They focus on getting the attention of the right people at the right time. If you're marketing Harley-Davidson motorcycles, trying to land an appearance on Oprah to show off this year's new models probably isn't the best strategy. Likewise, Oprah's core audience is not likely to include burly men in leather jackets with handlebar mustaches and tattoos, so don't expect her to pay for a marketing booth at a motorcycle trade show anytime soon. Your probable purchaser is the type of person who is perfectly suited to what you're offering. Harley's most profitable customer is the weekend warrior, middle-aged men with disposable income who want to feel powerful and dangerous while cruising around in their spare time. Oprah's probable purchasers are middle-aged women who want to improve themselves and enjoy listening to intimate confessions and emotional stories. Harley doesn't try to appeal to Oprah's probable purchasers and vice versa. They each focus on appealing to their specific core audience to great effect. Attempting to appeal to everyone is a waste of time and money. Focus your marketing efforts on your probable purchaser. By spending your limited resources reaching out to people who are already interested in the types of things you offer, you'll maximize the effectiveness of your attention-grabbing activities. Preoccupation. In order to earn the attention of a prospect, you must divert their attention from what they're already doing. That's not an easy task. Preoccupation is a fact of life for modern marketers. At the beginning of the marketing process, your prospects are paying attention to something else, not you. In order to attract attention to your offer, what you're doing must be more interesting than your prospect's current subject of attention. The best way to break a potential prospect's preoccupation is to provoke a feeling of curiosity, surprise, or concern. Our brains pay close attention to opportunities and threats, scanning the environment for new stimuli that could help or harm us. The stronger and more emotionally compelling the stimuli, the easier it is to attract attention. There's a reason marketers use evocative imagery, words, and sounds. Our brains are wired to stop what we're doing to evaluate them. That's not to say that your marketing needs to be garish and loud. There are thousands of subtle ways to attract attention that can work just as well. Depending on the prospect's environment or emotional state, the threshold of interest you need to generate may be low. If the prospect is bored, restless, or looking for entertainment or distraction, it'll be easier to attract their attention. It always pays to assume your prospects begin in a state of preoccupation. Begin your marketing approach in a way that breaks their preoccupation and earns their attention. End result. Most business opportunity seekers aren't interested in the day-to-day details and responsibilities of running a business. They buy business books and courses because they want to experience a more prosperous, abundant, and hopeful future. Most drivers don't buy expensive off-road capable vehicles because they actually drive off the road. They buy them because off-road capability makes them feel adventurous and bold, capable of meeting any driving challenge. Most women don't buy a $20 tube of lipstick for its color alone. They buy it because they believe it will make them more beautiful and desirable. Most college students don't pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to Harvard or Stanford or Yale just to sit in a class. They go, or rather their parents send them, because they believe they'll be perceived as sophisticated, intelligent, and powerful after they graduate. Marketing is most effective when it focuses on the desired end result, which is usually a distinctive experience or emotion related to a core human drive. The actual function of the purchase is important, but the end result is what the prospect is most interested in hearing about. It's often far more comfortable to focus on the features. You know what your offer does. Even so, it's far more effective to focus on the benefits, what your offer will provide to your customers. The end result is what matters most. By focusing on the end result, you're homing in on what will cause your prospect to conclude, "This is for me." Qualification. Believe it or not, it's often wise to turn away paying customers. Not every customer is a good customer. Customers who require more time, energy, attention, or risk than they're worth to your bottom line aren't worth attracting in the first place. Qualification is the process of determining whether or not a prospect is a good customer before they purchase from you. By evaluating a prospect before they buy, you can minimize the chance of wasting your time dealing with a customer who's not a good fit for your business. Progressive Insurance has turned qualification into a profitable business strategy. To see qualification in action, go to progressive.com and request a quote for car insurance. When you request a quote, Progressive asks you a set of basic questions. What type of car do you have? Do you own or lease it? If you own it, are you still making payments? What's your zip code? Are you married? Did you go to college? Have you had any at-fault accidents in the past 5 years, etc.? Progressive then uses your answers to gather data from a series of databases to answer two questions. A, are you the type of person Progressive wants to insure? And B, if so, how much should they charge to insure you? If you're the type of person Progressive wants as a customer, they'll quote you a price and encourage you to purchase an insurance policy immediately. If you're not, Progressive will tell you that you can get a better price elsewhere and actively encourage you to purchase insurance from one of their competitors. Why in the world would a business encourage a hot prospect to purchase from the competition? As you recall from our previous discussion of insurance, the profitability of an insurer depends on collecting as much money as possible in premiums while paying out as little money as possible in claims. Progressive doesn't want to maximize its total client base. It wants to insure only people who are likely to drive safely and have few accidents, which means attracting customers who will pay premiums for a long time without making claims. Qualification allows Progressive to maximize the number of highly profitable customers it insures while funneling the bad risks directly to their competition. It's good for customers as well. If they're good risks, they get lower rates on their car insurance. Screening your customers can help you filter out the bad customers before they do business with you. The more clearly you define your ideal customer, the better you can screen out the prospects who don't fit that description, and the more you'll be able to focus on serving your best customers well. Point of market entry. Assuming you don't have a small child and aren't expecting one anytime soon, you probably don't care about diapers, strollers, cribs, infant toys, daycare, and Baby Einstein DVDs. Any information you're exposed to about these things is likely to be filtered away by your brain, since it's not relevant to your life at the moment. But once you're expecting a little bundle of joy to enter your life, you suddenly care a great deal about these things, and will probably start actively searching for information about them. Before hearing the news, you had no reason to care. Now you do. Certain markets have clearly defined entry and exit points. Learning a newborn is on the way is an example of a point of market entry. Once you know you're expecting, you're suddenly much more receptive to information about products and services that will help you take care of a child. Attempting to attract the attention of people who don't care about what you do is a waste of time, money, and energy, so it's best to find out when people are interested in hearing from you before you reach out. Attracting your probable purchaser's attention immediately after they've reached the point of market entry is hugely valuable. Companies like Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark, Johnson & Johnson, and Fisher-Price pay an enormous amount of attention to points of market entry, since they have a huge impact on the effectiveness of every baby product-related marketing activity. It's not uncommon for new moms and dads to come home from the hospital with a complimentary care package from one or more of these companies containing samples of diapers, diaper rash ointment, formula, and other newborn care basics. If you can get a prospective customer's attention as soon as they become interested in what you're offering, you become the standard by which competing offers are evaluated. That's a remarkably powerful position that increases the likelihood that the prospect will ultimately purchase from you. Discovering where probable purchasers start looking for information after crossing the interest threshold is extremely valuable. Before the advent of the internet, most expecting parents immediately started devouring books and talking to more experienced family and friends. Today, newly minted moms and dads hit the web first, which is why organic and paid search engine marketing is often so valuable. By optimizing for keywords your prospective customers are likely to search for, you can ensure that they find you first. Addressability. A good salesman, as the old and politically incorrect saying goes, can sell a refrigerator to an Eskimo. It's a cliche, but there's some truth to it. Inuit who live above the Arctic Circle use insulated refrigerators to keep their food from freezing in sub-zero temperatures. The real barrier isn't need. It's finding these customers in the first place. Making the sale involves traveling thousands of miles through brutally wild terrain just to get their attention, let alone land a sale and deliver the product. Addressability is a measure of how easy it is to get in touch with people who might want what you're offering. A highly addressable audience can be reached quickly and easily. A non-addressable audience can only be reached with extreme hardship or isn't receptive and doesn't want to be reached at all. Yoga is a good example of a highly addressable market. It's relatively easy to find places where people are already paying attention to yoga-related information. Studios, popular magazines like Yoga Journal, conferences, websites, etc. Yoga is an $8 billion industry worldwide, and you can tap into some or all of these outlets to help yogis and yoginis learn more about what you have to offer. Sensitive or embarrassing topics tend to have low addressability, even if there's a huge need. Chronic medical conditions are a good example. It's difficult to find and reach a large group of people who suffer from an uncomfortable and potentially embarrassing condition like psoriasis or colitis. People suffering from these conditions typically don't gather in the same place or read the same things, and many will avoid being publicly identified as sufferers by joining organizations, so it's hard to find and talk to them directly. Doctors, on the other hand, are more addressable. They have publicly listed addresses and phone numbers and are willing and able to meet with drug company representatives about new offerings. Since each doctor sees many patients and acts as a gatekeeper for prescription medications, it's clear why pharmaceutical companies spend so much time and money marketing to MDs. The internet has dramatically improved the addressability of many markets. People who have a sensitive medical condition are highly likely to search for information anonymously on the internet, which is addressable via advertising. Blogs, discussion boards, and databases like WebMD.com make it easier for people who don't know one another to share their experiences and knowledge, making these low addressability markets more accessible than ever before. Addressability is a huge concern when you are developing a new offer. If you have a choice, it's far better to focus on building something for an addressable audience than it is to go around and hand sell or try to address an audience that is not naturally addressable or doesn't want to be addressed. If you choose to serve an addressable market before committing to an offer, it'll be significantly easier to market your offer without breaking the bank. Desire. Effective marketing makes your prospect want what you have to offer. In order for a prospect to be willing to pay you perfectly good money for what you're offering, they must want what you have. If your marketing activities don't produce some visceral feeling of desire in your prospects, you're wasting your time and money. Provoking desire is the part of marketing that makes most people uncomfortable. It's understandable. Pop culture is enamored with the image of the marketer as a shadowy master manipulator, hypnotizing the masses into wanting things they don't really want or need. Nothing could be further from the truth. Here's the reality. It's almost impossible to make someone want something they don't already desire. Yes, it's possible to be scammy and manipulative if you misrepresent what you're offering or promise something you can't deliver. Don't mistake that for brainwashing. The quickest way to waste a multi-million dollar advertising budget is to try to force people to want something they don't already want. The human mind simply doesn't work that way. We only purchase what we already desire on some level. The essence of effective marketing is discovering what people already want, then presenting your offer in a way that intersects with that pre-existing desire. The best marketing is similar to education-based selling, which we'll discuss later. It shows the prospect how the offer will help them achieve what they desire. Your job as a marketer isn't to convince people to want what you're offering. It's to help your prospects convince themselves that what you're offering will help them get what they really want. So what do people want? We've already covered that. The core human drives are a starting point that will help you discover what your market wants at the most basic level. The more drives you can connect with your offering, the more effective your marketing activities will be. Visualization. As soon as you step onto the lot of a car dealership, the salesperson you work with has a single, clear objective: convince you to get behind the wheel of a vehicle for a test drive. The test drive is used to sell cars all over the world for a very good reason. It works. The test drive is the most effective tool a salesperson has to convince you to purchase a car that day. Until you're actually driving a car, it's much easier to treat a potential purchase in a detached way. You're capable of rationally comparing makes and models, features, and prices. You can convince yourself that you're just looking, with no intention of purchasing anything just yet. Once you're actually behind the wheel of a car, however, the emotional parts of your mind take control. You start to imagine what your life would look like if you owned this vehicle. Instead of dispassionately comparing horsepower and acceleration metrics, you can actually feel the power of the engine and the ease of handling. And you can imagine the respect, or envy, of your neighbors as you pull your attractive new vehicle into the driveway. You've stopped comparing and started wanting. Once you start wanting, you'll probably buy. It's only a matter of time. B&H Photo Video uses the same strategy in a different market. Roaming the aisles of their Manhattan superstore is an intense sensory experience. You can feel the weight of the camera you're considering, watch how quickly it focuses, and hear the snap of the shutter. Better yet, you can compare the feel of each camera to hundreds of others, all within arm's reach. It's little wonder B&H is one of the most successful photography retailers in the world. After test driving a few cameras, it's extremely difficult to resist the urge to take one home. The most effective way to get people to want something is to encourage them to visualize what their life would be like once they've accepted your offer. As we'll discuss later in mental simulation, our minds are designed to automatically imagine the consequences of our actions. You can use this natural tendency to your advantage by helping your prospects imagine the positive experiences they'll have. If you encourage your prospects to visualize what their life would look like after purchasing, you increase the probability they'll purchase from you. The best way to help your customers visualize is to expose them to as much sensory information as possible, the information their mind uses to conclude, "I want this." Framing. In a famous experiment conducted by psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, participants were asked to make a decision about administering medical treatment to a sick population of 600 people. Participants in the study were given two options. Treatment A would save 200 lives. Treatment B had a 33% chance of saving all 600 people and a 66% probability of saving no one. Treatment A and B are mathematically identical. Statistically, there's no difference in the expected outcome. The results, however, revealed a clear psychological preference. 72% of participants chose treatment A, while 28% of the participants chose treatment B. The experiment was then repeated with two different treatment options. Treatment C would result in 400 deaths. Treatment D had a 33% chance that no one would die, but a 66% probability that all 600 would die. Participants overwhelmingly preferred treatment D, 78% to 22%. What's interesting to note is that treatments A and C are also identical, but A was overwhelmingly preferred while C was not. Contemplating lives saved with fatalities significantly altered the preferences of the people making decisions, even though the expected outcomes were exactly the same. We'll explore one of the reasons for this preference later in loss aversion, but for now, let's focus on how the emphasis of the various messages changed the results. Framing is the act of emphasizing the details that are critically important while de-emphasizing things that aren't, either by minimizing certain facts or leaving them out entirely. Proper use of framing can help you present your offer persuasively while honoring your customer's time and attention. Framing is a natural part of communication. Some form of compression in any message is inevitable. It's simply not practical to include all of the facts and context when communicating with others. We emphasize some details and leave out others to save time. We frame because we have to. Otherwise, it would take a huge amount of time to communicate even the simplest information with other people. It would take 2 hours to order a pizza as you told the person on the other end of the line not only the size and the toppings you wanted, but how you got their phone number and why on this particular evening you were in the mood for a slice as opposed to, say, General Tso's chicken. Since framing is an ever-present part of communication, it pays to be conscious of it. By being mindful of what you're emphasizing and what you're minimizing, you can communicate the benefits of your offer to your prospects in a clear, concise way, which maximizes your persuasive power. Framing is not the same thing as lying or being deceitful. Honesty is always the best policy, and not just from a moral perspective. Misrepresenting your offer may net a few more sales in the short term, but it dramatically increases the probability that your customer's expectations will be violated, decreasing their satisfaction and permanently harming your reputation. Using framing to your advantage will allow you to communicate the benefits of your offer to your probable purchasers persuasively, as long as you don't leave out information that your customers have a right to know. Free. If you want to attract attention quickly, give something valuable away for free. People love the promise of getting something for nothing. You've probably seen free samples of food being given away at the supermarket, or received an offer to try a product or service for a certain time at no obligation. Chances are, at least a few of those free offers have led you to purchase more. Offers of free value continue to exist because they work. The free value is subsidized by the additional sales that are made because of the offer. I started my teaching and consulting business by giving away my research and writing for free on my website. As a result, hundreds of thousands of people find, or are referred to, the Personal MBA, benefit from the information, and come to trust me as a useful resource. More often than not, they give me permission to continue providing even more free information via email. Periodically, I offer to meet with prospective consulting customers by phone for free. There's no obligation whatsoever on their part, and I don't hold anything back. Every time I make this offer, I receive hundreds of requests and meet many new and interesting people. A good percentage of the people who accept a free sample become paying customers, making free the foundation of my teaching and consulting business. More often than not, offering genuine free value is a quick and effective way to attract attention. By giving your prospects something useful at no cost up front, you earn their attention and give your potential customers a chance to actually experience the value you provide. Done well, this strategy will net you sales you wouldn't have made otherwise. Giving free value attracts attention, but always remember that attention alone doesn't pay the bills. The siren song of quote-unquote going viral encourages many business owners to continually give away too much in an effort to chase attention, over-establishing and improving the profit-generating parts of their business. Attention is necessary to attract paying customers, but if that attention never leads to sales, it won't sustain your business. For best results, focus on giving away real free value that is likely to attract real paying customers. Permission. I just did the unthinkable. I actually opened the spam folder in my email account. The folder contained 1,555 unread messages, most of which were some variant of "Hot Russian babes want to chat with you," "Buy Viagra online," or "Eliminate hair loss instantly." I didn't ask for any of these emails. The spammers just sent them, without considering whether or not I wanted them. I have absolutely no interest in chatting with hot Russian babes. I have no use for black market Viagra, and I actually like being bald. How likely am I to read these messages, let alone respond to them? Not likely at all. On the contrary, I'll go out of my way to avoid paying attention to them, and it'll be a cold day in hell before I purchase what they're pushing. Unfortunately, many business people assume that the spam approach is the best way to get attention. Unsolicited phone calls, press releases, mass market advertising, and resident addressed direct mail are the most common legal equivalents of spam, blanketing a huge, undifferentiated group of people with a standard message in the hopes that a tiny fraction will respond. In the early days of television and radio advertising, commercial interruptions actually worked. When there were only three channels, people were more likely to pay attention during the commercials. By purchasing a single 30-second primetime advertising slot on each of the three major networks, you could reach 90% of the television-watching population in a single day. Now, people have the ability to filter out anything they don't want to pay attention to, either by ignoring the offending message or by shifting their attention to something else. The moment you start talking about something your prospects don't care about, they're gone. Asking for permission to follow up after providing free value is more effective than interruption. Offering genuine value earns your prospects' attention, and asking for permission gives you the opportunity to focus on communicating with people you know are interested in what you have to offer. Permission is a real asset. Reaching new people tends to be difficult and expensive. It's far easier to follow up with someone you already know. All it takes is an email, a letter, or a phone call, all of which are easy and inexpensive. If you ask the new prospects you meet for permission to follow up, you're making the most of your outreach activities. The best way to get permission is to ask for it. Whenever you provide value to people, ask them if it's okay to continue to give them more value in the future. Over time, your list of prospective customers will grow, and the larger it grows, the higher the likelihood you'll start landing more sales. Use permission once you have it, but don't abuse the privilege. Getting permission to follow up never gives you carte blanche to send them anything you like. Before asking your prospects for permission to follow up, make it clear what they'll be getting and how it will benefit them. If you honor your commitments by continually providing value and refraining from spamming your prospects with irrelevant information, you'll have a powerful asset that can help you build a deeper relationship with the people who are interested in what you're offering. Hook. Complicated messages are ignored or forgotten. Your probable purchasers are busy. They don't have time to pay attention to all of the information assaulting them every day. If you want people to remember who you are and what you're offering, you have to grab their attention and hold it, all in a matter of seconds. A hook is a single phrase or sentence that describes an offer's primary benefit. Sometimes the hook is a title, and sometimes it's a short tagline. Regardless, it conveys the reason someone would want what you're selling. A classic example of a hook in the publishing world is the title of Timothy Ferris's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. This short title implies several intriguing benefits. Number one, 4 hours is a lot less than most people work, and most people would like to work less. Number two, you can potentially earn as much in 4 hours a week as in 40-plus hours a week. And number three, if you're not working so much, you could do other cool things with your time. That's not bad at all for four short words. When paired with the book's cover image of a guy relaxing in a hammock on a tropical beach, the title goes a long way in convincing people to purchase and read the book. Apple used a hook for the launch of the iPod, 1,000 songs in your pocket. At the time, portable music players consisted of bulky CD and cassette players, and advertising for early MP3 players focused on geek speak, megabytes of disk space. Apple's hook highlighted the primary benefit. Instead of carrying around hundreds of tapes or CDs, you could carry your entire music collection in one elegant device. Apple's five-word tagline worked wonders. In a little under a year, 236,000 first-generation iPods were sold. An astounding start, considering this was the company's first foray into the portable music category. The hook grabbed attention, and the quality of the product closed the sale. When creating a hook, focus on the primary benefit or value your offer provides. Emphasize what's uniquely valuable about your offer and why the prospect should care. Brainstorm a list of words and phrases related to your primary benefit, then experiment with different ways to connect them in a short phrase. Crafting a hook is a creative exercise. The more potential options you generate, the more quickly you'll find one that works. Once you've created your hook, use it. Place it on your website, your advertising, your business cards. Make it one of the first things potential customers see. The hook grabs attention, and the remainder of your marketing and sales activities close the deal. The better your hook, the more attention you'll grab, and the easier it'll be for your satisfied customers to tell their friends about you. Call to action. Attracting a prospect's attention doesn't help if they disappear. If you want to make a sale, you need to direct your prospects to take some kind of action. Your prospects can't read your mind. If you want your prospects to take the next step you're encouraging, you need to tell them exactly what to do. The most effective marketing messages give the recipient or prospect a single, very clear, very short action to take next. Think about a roadside billboard that says something like, "Tony's hamburgers are the best." What will people who see that message do? Nothing, probably. In all likelihood, the billboard is a waste of time and money. Give them a call to action like, "Take exit 25 and turn right for the best burgers in town, and soon Tony will be serving more hamburgers to hungry travelers." A call to action directs your prospects to take a single, simple, obvious action. Visit a website, enter an email address, call a phone number, mail a self-addressed stamped envelope, click a button, purchase a product, tell a friend. The key to presenting an effective call to action is to be as clear, simple, and obvious as you possibly can. The more clearly you present your proposal, the higher the probability your prospect will actually do what you suggest. If you're encouraging someone to enter their email address to sign up for a newsletter, say that verbatim multiple times and make it immediately clear where the email address field is, why they should fill it out, what to click once they've entered their email, and what they can expect to happen when they do. If you think you're being too obvious, you're doing it right. The best calls to action ask directly either for the sale or for permission to follow up. Making direct sales is optimal since it makes it easy to figure out whether or not your marketing activities are cost-effective. Asking for permission is the next best thing, since it allows you to follow up with your prospects over time, dramatically decreasing your marketing costs and increasing the probability of an eventual sale. Ensure that every message you create has a clear call to action, and you'll immediately increase the effectiveness of your marketing efforts. Narrative. Since the dawn of history, people have been telling stories. Telling stories is a universal human experience, and stories have always been used in the conduct of trade. A good story will make even the best offer even better. Most compelling narratives around the world follow a common format. The world-renowned mythologist Joseph Campbell called this prototypical storyline the hero's journey, or the monomyth. People all over the world respond very strongly to the story motif, and you can use this basic format to craft and tell your own stories. The hero's journey begins by introducing the hero, a normal person who is experiencing the trials and tribulations of everyday life. The hero then receives a call to adventure, a challenge, quest, or responsibility that requires them to rise above their normal existence and hone their skills and abilities in order to prevail. When the hero accepts the call, they depart their normal experience and enter into a world of uncertainty and adventure. A series of remarkable experiences initiates them into the new world, and the hero undergoes many trials and learns many secrets in the pursuit of ultimate success. After persevering in the face of adversity and vanquishing the foe, the hero receives a mighty gift or power, then returns to the normal world to share this knowledge, wisdom, or treasure with the people. In return, the hero receives the respect and admiration of all. Your customers want to be heroes. They want to be respected and admired by all, to be powerful, successful, and determined in the face of adversity. They want to be inspired by the trials and tribulations of other people who have come before and vanquished the foe. Telling a story about people who have already walked the path your prospects are considering is a powerful way to make them interested in proceeding. Testimonials, case studies, and other stories are extremely effective in encouraging your prospects to accept your call to adventure. By telling stories about the customers who have come before, you grab your prospects' attention and show them a path to achieve what they want. The more vivid, clear, and emotionally compelling the story, the more prospects you'll attract. Tell your prospective customers the stories they're interested in hearing, and you'll inevitably grab their attention. Controversy. Controversy means publicly taking a position that not everyone will agree with, approve of, or support. Used constructively, controversy can be an effective way to attract attention. People start talking, engaging, and paying attention to your position, which is a very good thing. The personal MBA itself is a good example of the power of positive controversy. The personal MBA is about fundamental business principles, what you need to understand about business in order to succeed. I firmly believe that anyone can learn whatever they need to know about business independently, without mortgaging their future earnings by enrolling in a traditional MBA program. Some people disagree with that position, particularly graduates of Ivy League business school programs. MBA graduates and candidates are often quite vocal in their disagreement, which usually takes the form of denouncing the personal MBA approach to business education on their own website or publicly disagreeing with me by leaving comments on mine. That's not a bad thing. This consistent level of mild controversy has allowed the personal MBA to grow year after year without paid advertising. By making their thoughts known, the personal MBA's detractors are spreading the word to people who may not have been aware of alternatives to traditional business school programs. The controversy leads many new people to investigate and examine the personal MBA and make up their own minds about its usefulness. More than a few of them stick around, read my free content, then decide to purchase a book, take a course, or hire me as a consultant. As long as my detractors keep things civil, I welcome the disagreement. It's okay to have an opinion and to take a strong stand. Everyone has a natural tendency to want other people to like them, and disagreement is often uncomfortable. In an effort to be unobjectionable, it's easy to water down your opinions to the point where they offend no one. If your position is agreeable to everyone, it becomes so boring that no one will pay attention to you. It's okay to support a position that not everyone else supports. It's okay to disagree with someone, or to call someone out, or to position yourself against something, because controversy provokes a discussion. Discussion is attention, which is a very good thing if you want to attract people who will benefit from what you're doing. That's not to say all controversy is good controversy. There's a fine line between being constructively controversial and creating a soap opera. Controversy with a purpose is valuable. Controversy for the sake of controversy, or controversy that belittles and demeans, is not. Controversy won't help you if you lose sight of the purpose behind your actions. As long as you're able to maintain a sense of the bigger picture of how you're trying to help, creating a bit of controversy can be a very effective tool in encouraging people to seek out more information about what you're doing. Reputation. In my opinion, the term branding is one of the most overused and overhyped ideas in the modern business world. There's nothing magical or complex about building a brand. When business professionals say they want to enhance their brand or build brand equity, they almost always mean improve their reputation. Reputation is what people generally think about a particular offer or company. Reputations naturally arise whenever people talk to one another. Some products and services are worth the price, others are not. Some experiences are worth having, others are not. Some people are good to work with, others are not. No one wants to waste their time or money, so people pay very close attention to what other people say about the things they're interested in. Building a strong reputation is hugely valuable. People are often willing to pay a premium for a good reputation. One of the reasons well-known consumer brands like Tide and Crest can continue to charge premium prices in near-commodity categories is the strength of their reputation. Potential customers want to feel certain that the purchase they're considering will benefit them, that others will think highly of their decision, and that they won't be wasting their money. As the venerable corporate saying goes, no one ever got fired for buying IBM. It's important to note that your reputation is not directly under your control. It's the sum total of what others think about everything you do, the products you release, the advertising you promote, and the customer service you provide. No matter how hard you try, you can't directly manage your reputation. You can only try to improve it over time by making people glad they chose to do business with you. Always remember that the marketplace is the final arbiter of your reputation and that it's always watching what you do. When you build a great reputation, your customers will continue to do business with you and will refer you to others because they think highly of you, and because referring friends to good products and services is a way to build their own reputation. Building your reputation takes time and effort, but it's the most effective kind of marketing there is. Chapter 3. Sales. Every successful business ultimately sells what it has to offer. Having millions of prospects isn't enough if no one ultimately pulls out their wallet and says, "I'll take one." The sales process begins with a prospect and ends with a paying customer. No sale, no business. The best businesses in the world earn the trust of their prospects and help them understand why the offer is worth paying for. No one wants to make a bad decision or be taken advantage of, so sales mostly consists of helping the prospect understand what's important and convincing them you're capable of actually delivering on what you promise. The end of the sales process is an excited new customer and more cash in the bank. Transaction. A transaction is an exchange of value between two or more parties. If I have something you want and you have something I want, we'd be both better off if we agreed to trade. The transaction is the defining moment of every business. Sales are the only point in the business cycle where resources flow into the business, which makes completing transactions critically important. Businesses survive by bringing in more money than they spend, and there's no way to do that without completing transactions. You can only transact with things that are economically valuable. If you don't have anything your prospective customers want, they won't buy from you. This may seem obvious, but it's amazing how many prospective business people enter a market without something the market wants. That's why developing and testing a minimum viable offer is so important. It's the best way to determine whether or not you've created something valuable enough to sell before you invest your life savings. When you're starting a new business, the object is to get to the point where you make your first profitable transaction as quickly as you possibly can, because that's the point where you transition from being a project to being a business. The examples and concepts in this chapter will help you create profitable transactions that both parties are happy with. Trust. Here's a proposal. Send me a certified bank check for $100,000 right now, and in 10 years, I'll give you the keys to a brand new 10,000 square foot villa on Italy's Amalfi Coast. You can't see any example villas, you won't hear from me again until the villa is ready, and there are absolutely no refunds. Do we have a deal? Unless you are an extremely trusting soul with cash to burn, probably not. After all, how can you be sure I can actually build you a seaside mansion for such a paltry sum? How can you be sure I won't just take the money and disappear? You can't, which is why you shouldn't cut me or anyone else a check for a villa on the Mediterranean you've never seen.